This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with NPR reporter and author Joe Shapiro. But first, disability news for the week of October 29th, 2018. Federal contractors may soon get one more reason to prioritize hiring workers with disabilities. The U.S. Department of Labor is looking to incentivize inclusive hiring practices among employers who do business with the government through a so-called Excellence in Disability Inclusion Award. Federal contractors that foster employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities could be exempt from 2 years' worth of compliance evaluations under the Labor Department plan put forward this month. In order to qualify for the award, contractors must have an affirmative action plan or an initiative to promote opportunities for people with disabilities, have no outstanding compliance issues, and meet a series of other requirements. The notice outlines the plan to issue the new award, which would be administered by the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs in conjunction with the Office of Disability Employment Policy. It reads, quote, "The Excellence in Disability Inclusion Award seeks to highlight successful practices and strategies that have expanded and improved the recruitment, hiring, retention, and promotion opportunities of individuals with disabilities. By highlighting the exemplary practices of successful contractor establishments, other covered federal contractors should be encouraged to adopt these or similar practices to support their compliance with mandatory obligations under Section 503," end quote. The effort is the Labor Department's latest to encourage contractors to improve their track records on disability employment. Already, the agency requires most federal contractors to aim for ensuring that at least 7% of their workforce is comprised of people with disabilities. The Labor Department's plan for the new award is up for public comment through December 4th. Settlements totaling more than $1 million have been reached in the case of a 16-year-old Montana student with disabilities who was allegedly removed from his school, placed in a church basement, and told to watch DVDs and sort nuts and bolts. The student and his family will receive around $1,141,000 in compensation from the Montana Office of Public Instruction and the school district where he was enrolled. The student is referred to only as RC in legal documents to protect his identity. Because the student goes to school in a rural part of Montana, the school district is also unnamed in court documents to avoid revealing his identity. The majority of the settlement money will go to the teen's future education under neuropsychology expert Dr. Helena Huckabee of Denver. Only $35,000 of the total amount was paid to the family in damages, including $25,000 from the school district and $10,000 from OPI. The school district agreed to pay up to $175,000 in educational service fees for the first year and up to $150,000 per year for the following 5 years. The 6 years of total service compensates the teen, RC, for the two remaining years he was eligible for education and the 4 years he was allegedly denied education by the district. Because the district allegedly failed to provide an education for the student, this program will act as a substitute. Superintendent of Public Instruction Elsie Arntzen made the decision to settle, quote, based on the best interests of the student and also to bring this longstanding litigation to a close, end quote. The original lawsuit stated that in 2014, RC was segregated from other students and moved to the basement of a nearby Lutheran church. At the time, the suit claimed that several public officials were aware of the issues but failed to act in order to provide RC see with adequate educational services. Disability Rights Montana had previously filed an administrative complaint with OPI under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, a federal law that provides grant money to states and requires schools to provide special education services to qualified students. In September 2016, RC's mother filed a formal complaint with OPI, which led to an investigation. OPI found the student was not receiving services and directed the district to take specific action to provide services within 60 days. This was under the administration of Dennis Juno, superintendent of public instruction at the time the incident started. The district never complied and OPI never enforced its own order, according to court documents. 1 year after the demands were reiterated, this settlement was reached between the involved parties. The compensation mostly comes in the form of education and treatment for RC. RC's educational program will include multidisciplinary instruction that includes applied behavior analysis therapy, trauma-focused services, transition services, academic instruction, assistive technology, supplementary aid and related services such as speech, occupational, and physical therapy. The implementation for RC's educational services began in the 2018-19 school year and will run through the 2023-24 school year. And finally, the number of characters with disabilities on primetime television this year is set to hit a record high. There will be 18 regularly appearing characters with disabilities on primetime network shows during the 2018-19 season, accounting for 2.1% of portrayals. The count comes from a report released Thursday by GLAAD, a media advocacy organization for the gay and lesbian community. The group annually assesses representation of minority groups, including people with disabilities, on television. GLAAD looked at 857 characters expected to appear on scripted primetime shows broadcast on five major networks. NBC will feature the greatest number of characters with disabilities at six, the report found, followed by the CW at four, ABC and CBS at three each, and Fox at two. Characters include a physician with autism on The Good Doctor, a teen with cerebral palsy on Speechless, and multiple shows featuring wheelchair users. By comparison, last year's report found 16 characters with disabilities on primetime television, or 1.8% of those portrayed. This year's number is the highest since GLAAD started tracking the prevalence of disabilities on television in 2010. Nonetheless, the report notes that disability representation on television remains far short of the true percentage of Americans with disabilities. And that's the news for this week.
She drove me home in her Lexus car. Like a dog, but I don't watch a show. Spend my time with the radio. Seen her dancing on the Sunset Strip. Bell-bottom jeans and a curvy hips. Seen her sitting there with her boyfriend.
This is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today on the phone by Joe Shapiro. Joe is the author of a book that has become really a textbook on disability rights, at least here in the University of Illinois, for sure, and I know other places as well, and is also a correspondent with NPR, who covers frequently stories related to disability issues. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thank you, Vicki.
So glad to have you on. I've known of your work for a long time, own a couple of copies of your book, and was just really excited when I had the opportunity to have you on the show. So why don't we start by having you introduce yourself to the listeners that may not have heard of you before?
All right. Well, I think you introduced me well. I've been writing about disability issues as a journalist since about 1988. I took some time off to write this book, No Pity, People with Disabilities, Forging a New Civil Rights Movement. You know, it came out in 1993, but it's still in print. It's still used a lot, as you said, on college campuses when somebody goes to work for a disability organization for the first time, or when somebody's dealing with disability in a family for the first time. Because a lot of it talks about disability civil rights history. It talks about the fact that there is a disability civil rights movement, that people with disabilities see their issues as civil rights issues, not health issues anymore, not medical issues, as you educate people on your show. I started writing about disability issues, and I was a social policy reporter, and I found that disability touched every area I could possibly write about, whether it was education or poverty or housing or healthcare, you name it. Disability is in everything that I cover.
So you don't have necessarily a personal connection to disability.
I don't. I'm not a person with a disability. I don't have a family. I didn't have a family member with a disability when I started doing this. I had been a political correspondent, and then I had a career as a foreign correspondent, and I was stationed overseas in Rome, and I thought I was going to be a foreign correspondent for a long time, and then there was a economic downturn, and my magazine closed a bunch of bureaus overseas. I came home. I didn't have anything to. I was looking for a new thing to cover. I was assigned to social policy, and somebody already covered health, and somebody already covered poverty. Those were the two big areas, and I was looking for something else. And actually, the way I got involved in disability was sort of an accident. I got a call from a PR person who told me that there were a bunch of people with disabilities who were meeting in a hotel in Washington, and they were drafting something that they were calling the Americans with Disabilities Act. So in 1988, I went to one of those early meetings of the first version of the ADA being drawn up, and I was there in a room with some of these early civil rights advocates of disability civil rights. People like Justin Dart were there, and Lex Fridin, and I heard them talking about disability as a civil rights issue. I never really thought of it as a civil rights issue. People just weren't talking about disability that way. And I always tell the story that I tell this in the book, that I sat in that room and they're drafting what would become this first version of the ADA, and I'm trying to, understand what they're talking about. Talking about it in civil rights language. And I was not sure quite quick. That I went outside the hotel. I got in line to get a cab back to my office. I was in line. There was a man in a wheelchair behind me. There were two cabs. The first one picked me up, and the second cab saw him, the man in the wheelchair, and did a U-turn and just left him there. Wasn't going to pick him up. And it occurred to me, that's when it sort of clicked. That it occurred to me. I thought, if you can, in Washington, D.C., we have a good subway system that's accessible, but the subway only goes so far. So if you depend on the subway, you can't take a cab. That would affect where you live, where you work, where you go to school. And it just sort of it clicked at that moment, and I understood it.
Well,
and by the way, I should say that the writer John Hockenberry and the journalist John Hockenberry, who now works at WNYC, heard me tell that story once. He said, Joe, if you really got it, you would have told your cab to stop and go back and get the guy in the wheelchair. But I was evil. That was the start of my evolution.
Yeah, your first realization, which, there are a lot of people out there who never really consider disability rights as a political movement. It's, in fact, they still think of it in the medical realm. So you came upon it very easily, I think, more so than a lot of people would.
It was something that, as I started writing, the more I wrote about disability issues, the more interested I got, the better stories I found. And people with disabilities were very good and patient teachers. And some of the early founders of the civil rights movement, people like Ed Roberts in California, and Justin Dart, who I mentioned, who helped create a lot of the pressure for the Americans with Disabilities Act, Judy Heumann, who now is the State Department advisor on disability civil rights and spreading the idea of disability rights.
Awesome.
Around the world.
Some very big name people out there for sure in the movement. So when you started with this project, did it start out to be a book, or was it going to be a series of news reports or articles, or what was your intent?
Well, I was a journalist looking for a good story. And the first one I did, by the way, I couldn't get published in my magazine, in my news magazine, because my editors thought it just seemed so far-fetched that disability would be seen as a civil rights issue. This is the story that I came back from that meeting where they were drafting the original version of the ADA. And it would be a few years before the ADA would get passed, so it wasn't that version that was going to get passed. But my editors were skeptical, and I couldn't even get the story published. But something changed, and then the following year, fall of 87. Fall of 87, because then in 88, then the Gallaudet student protest happened. And just a few months later, in February of 1988, and then that's the point where I think that was really important, because that got more national attention. The Nightline was very interested in that issue, and put a lot of these students on Nightline, and the national press sort of wrote about it, and I got to write about that for my magazine, and that was a part where students, deaf students at Gallaudet, which is the sort of premier, which is a school for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and they had never had a deaf person as the president. And that winter, they were setting out to find a new president, and the board of trustees picked a woman who was hearing, and she'd never had any experience with the deaf community, and the students objected, and they took over the campus and demanded that the process be reopened and that a deaf person be considered as for the presidency of the deaf school. They said, how can this be that and by the way, there was a controversy because the head of the board of trustees was at least it was interpreted that she said that deaf people are not ready to have such an important job. That created a lot of outrage, and they closed down the school, and they said this is a civil rights issue, and they got I. King Jordan, who had been a administrator at Gallaudet, became the new president, and that's interesting was for me, because first of all it was one of the first things that I did cover, and it allowed me to continue this interest, but that was winter of 1988. And then the new version of the ADA would be introduced and would pass in 1990, signed by President George H.W. Bush. And I think that the Gallaudet student protest had a lot to do with the later passage of the ADA, because the Gallaudet protest, those student protests, helped people understand, there's a civil rights aspect to the things that face people who are deaf, people have disabilities.
It's amazing to me that, we're coming up on almost 30 years of the ADA, and you were at the beginning of that, 26 years, but, in just a few years. And I wonder, since you were there at the beginning and you do report on issues fairly frequently, what change can you observe, or has there been any change in the way the general public perceives disability issues?
There's been a lot of change, and most of the changes come from people with disabilities themselves recognizing they have rights and expecting more and exercising those rights and expecting to be full citizens of the society and having more opportunities. When your rights are protected, it means that you have just something simple like a curb cut means you can get around, or a ramp to a building means you can get into a place to work. There's a lot more access now than there was 25 years ago. Now, have attitudes changed? Not always. There are still a lot of fights. There are fights over things like the right of a person with a disability to be a parent. Sometimes it comes up in custody fights, for example. A non-disabled parent will argue that the parent with a disability is less capable of being a parent. The disability doesn't is not something that gets in the way of that. So you do find fights. There's still they're constantly things or attitudes. I mean, I saw something that ran just recently, I think this week, in the Internal Medicine Journal of the Journal of American Medical Association that asked people what they feared more than death, and it was disabling conditions. It was needing someone to get you in and out of bed. It was dementia. It was things that were conditions of disabling conditions, and people said they feared that worse than death. They'd rather be dead than that. So I think people with disabilities are showing us that you can lead a good life with a disability. They're showing us how to do that, and I think one of the biggest changes that is yet to come is going to be changing our understanding of aging. I'm not saying that it's easy to live with a disability, but people with disabilities lead full lives and good lives, and they're showing us how to do that.
So what are the stories that you've been working on most recently? I'm sure there's a wide range of things that you cover for NPR, but I'm thinking specifically related to disability issues.
Right. So right now I'm on the investigative unit at NPR. So I have actually been doing a lot of criminal justice reporting, but criminal justice has a large disability element to it. Mm-hmm. A large number of people with various disabilities end up in the prison system, a disproportionate number with mental health issues, substance abuse issues, intellectual disabilities. So those things all come up. But what am I reporting? Let's see. Last year, on the 25th anniversary of the ADA, which was July 26, 2015, I did some stories just about that, about the legacy of the ADA, and I did a story where I followed a lawyer in New York. I followed him around. He'd sued, brought a bunch of lawsuits in New York, and I tried to show that the things that he won for people with disabilities ended up helping everyone. So, for example, we went to a subway station where he sued and got the city to install an elevator. And mm-hmm. We sat there. We were there, and I was there with the lawyer, and I was there with a man in a wheelchair, and we watched for an hour who used the elevator. We didn't see anyone in a wheelchair use the elevator, but that elevator was constantly in motion, up and down, and it was older people. It was people with rolling, grocery carts, with suitcases, with
strollers.
Strollers, right, exactly. So and just anyone who didn't want to climb those steep stairs, and the point was that these things that we've done for people with disabilities end up helping all of us. I'm trying right now, by the way, maybe people in your audience can help me. I'm trying to do a story about the issue of sexual assault of people with disabilities. I think I may concentrate on people with developmental disabilities, intellectual disability, autism. So I'm trying to look at that. That's a group where they have much higher rates of being the victims of sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
and yet there's this assumption somehow that these cases are hard to prosecute or they can't be won. So investigators don't investigate, prosecutors don't bring them. So I'm trying to do that story. That I hope will come up. I did a story not long ago about the use of restraints and seclusion of children mm-hmm. with disabilities in school. I did some stories several years ago about, what was your first news item today, the whole idea of how much of our Medicaid money goes to providing long-term care in community settings, and that was the focus of my story about 5 years ago. I looked at, had the nation and the states kept the promise of the Supreme Court's ruling in Olmstead, which guarantees a right for people to get their long-term care in the least restrictive environment, to get it outside of a nursing home, and this issue of trying to move that funding, that Medicaid funding, this is in your newscast, to try to spend more money on care in one's own community, in one's home, rather than in a nursing home. We did a series on that. We looked at, I did stories about the large number of young people who end up in nursing homes. It was interesting that the group that is growing the fastest, the nursing home population that's growing the fastest, not people over 65, that's mm-hmm. steady. It's working age people, and often because there are no alternatives, other places for them to go. But it was people between the age of 30 and 64. That was the population that was going up the most in nursing homes. And we also did a Freedom of Information Act request to get federal data. We show how different it is from state to state who ends up in a nursing home. A condition that you can have in one state may mean that you end up in a nursing home, but another state it doesn't. So this is from these numbers are more than 5 years old now, but Illinois was a place that had a large number of people in nursing homes.
Yeah, we're at the bottom of the list when it comes to community inclusive options for people.
So we looked at those activities of daily living that are supposed to determine level of disability. So, for example, the ability to walk by yourself. In Illinois, 21% of people in nursing homes could walk. They were able to walk by themselves, 21%. But in Hawaii and South Carolina, fewer than 5% could walk by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in Illinois, about 12% of people in nursing homes, they were able to bathe themselves without any assistance. But in Iowa and South Dakota, only 1% could bathe themselves without assistance. So in Iowa and South Dakota, you had to be pretty... have a pretty significant disability to wind up in a nursing home. That meant there were more options for you to live in your own home. Illinois was behind.
Well, Joe, we're out of time. I'm going to have to say goodbye, but I'll have to email you. I have a source for you on your issue of sexual assault for people with disabilities.
All right.
I'll be in touch.
It's my email is jshapiro@npr.org if people have ideas.
Great. Thanks for joining me. Joe Shapiro,
thank you.
Author of No Pity and correspondent with National Public Radio. Thanks for joining me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by my guest on the phone, Beth Gallagher. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by my guest on the phone, okay, multiple problems with technology today. So that is today's episode of Disability Beat, and we have some upcoming programming that I think you will be interested in. But before we do that, I have the Art Theater listing for this week. The Old Man and the Gun screens for one more week. The movie concerns Forrest Tucker, played by Robert Redford, who makes an audacious escape from San Quentin, going on to pull a spree of heists that confound authorities but fascinate the public. In pursuit is Detective John Hunt, who becomes captivated with the criminal's illegal skill set. The film also stars Sissy Spacek as Jewel, who is charmed by Tucker. Bisbee 17. Combining collaborative documentary, Western, and musical elements, the film follows several members of a close-knit community as they attempt to reckon with their town's darkest hour, known as the Bisbee Deportation. This movie will screen tomorrow, Tuesday, October 30th at 7 p.m. And on Wednesday, October 31st at 10 p.m., get your holiday fright night on with the yearly classic Halloween from 1978. To ensure up-to-date days and times, consult the website at www.theartheater.org. And coming up next is Rootstock Radio, followed by In the Know with your host, Sherry Williamson, which is a pre-recorded program of the show. And now here is this week's episode of Rootstock Radio.
Welcome to Rootstock Radio. Join us as host Teresa Marquez talks to leaders from the good food movement about food,